Welcome to the Word Search Podcast with Bible teacher and author Rob Price. Each topic and series on Word Search is designed to encourage your personal journey into the treasures and truths inside the Scriptures. Word Search is produced by RP Media, a leader in faith-based podcasts.
Well, this is lesson four of our study, Maturing into Childhood, and this one's titled, Searching for Significance, the Loved Child. Not the love child, the loved child. And in this episode, we're going to attempt to explore how Abba Father designed a human being to experience true meaning and worth. Think about this. What is it that really makes a person significant? What is it that defines how we understand our own value? And could it be that positions of authority, personal appearance, social media image, possessions, and wealth are just really empty vessels of approval? Let's quickly review again our theme verse out of Matthew 18, beginning in verse number 1. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked him, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And he called a little child and had him stand among them. And he said, "I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." Now, this passage happened shortly after the transfiguration experience of Jesus that, really, remember, only Peter, James, and John witnessed back in Matthew 17. And it's inferred here in the Greek that they were gone for 6 days, not after 6 days of the previous account. So imagine you're one of the other nine fellas. What is going on through your mind when they come back and you ask them, "Hey, guys, where you been?" And they act like they've been lawyered up by Perry Mason because Jesus said, "Don't talk about this right now," right? And then right before the question of our theme verse, we see a story about money, the temple tax. Peter is told to go catch a fish, and he'll find a coin inside the mouth of the fish to pay for the taxes. Crazy, right? It's like the gospel's magic money moment. And then with the mysterious 6 missing days that happened right before, we have the setup here for what happens in the verse I just read. And what's interesting is just 2 chapters later, I call it the request for royalty. There was a family political power grab. Let me read it to you. Matthew 20. There's also an account in Matthew 10. But Matthew 20, in verses number 20 through 23, tells us this. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favor of him. "What is it you want?" he asked. She said, "Grant that one of these 2 sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom." "You don't know what you're talking about," Jesus said to them. "Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right hand or left hand is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they've been prepared by my Father." When the 10 heard about this, they were indignant with the 2 brothers, and I assume the mom as well. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Indeed, instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." And we see perhaps the same story or something pretty close to it in Mark 10, verse 35. And this time it's just the 2 sons. The mother's not mentioned here. And it's basically the same thing. They said, "We would like you to grant that we may sit one on your right and one on your left in your glory." But Jesus said again, "You do not know what you're asking." So either way, whether mom's there or mom's not there, what is happening here? And so there are several possibilities here we need to reconcile. Either the boys tried first and got nowhere and had to ask mom to give it a try since they figured Jesus had a special affection for Aunt Mary, or perhaps all 3 were together at the same time and all 3 peppered him with the same questions. But as the passage says in verse 24 of Matthew 20, the other 10 disciples were not happy. In fact, they were indignant and they were ticked off at their audacity. I mean, who can blame them, right? I mean, they've just been gone 6 days. They know something's up. I mean, these guys are just still fighting, clawing, climbing the corporate ladder of Jesus Incorporated right up to the triumphal entry in Matthew 21. And then Jesus uses a compare and contrast analogy here to show his followers the wrong way to think. He He says, listen, it's not about lording over people. You want to be great, you got to be a servant. So again, Jesus lays down the path to true power in God's kingdom. So we see here again the adult mindset, it's back, rearing its ugly head, and it's very easily ensnared by the opportunity to control other people. These men, you see, they knew Jesus was the real deal. They felt like they were on the inside track and like they'd hit the lottery, like they'd received some insider trader information, and they fully intended to leverage it. We, though, we should be very careful what we ask for as well. The request may be very painful to our flesh. Basically, Jesus asks them if they're ready to suffer physical pain, death. And he tells them their pride is going to be shot to pieces if they desire real kingdom authority and power. So what were these men in search of? Let's go back to the title of the lesson. Significance. They wanted to matter in the kingdom. They wanted, can I say, influence. They wanted their presence to carry weight, but it was in all the wrong ways. So let's not fall for fake significance in the kingdom. The adult mindset offers a lot of ways to hold strong our affections on something that appears very appealing, but are they really just strongholds that keep us locked inside that silent bondage inside our thought life? I heard one pastor once talk about this, and he said, a stronghold is a lie that you really believe is the truth. Well, here's three lies about what gives us significance. Number one, significance is not found in owning a bunch of things and stuff. We think that if we have this car and that house and that neighborhood and this smartphone and that computer and this piece of jewelry and these types of clothes and this pair of shoes and those season tickets and that big screen TV and so on, that these luxuries give us meaning and position and significance. It's a lie, friends. It's a lie. I know that because the child mind tells me this. On a recent summer trip to West Virginia, my wife and I watched our two nieces and two nephews while their parents were off on an Alaskan cruise. Now, this house is loaded with toys. Upstairs, playroom, downstairs, full basement, toys, 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 in the bedrooms, outside in the backyard, etc. Kids stuff everywhere. But you know what? They spent most of their time playing with a simple race car track, or perhaps drawing, or playing baseball with me outside. Now, I'm not saying to skip handing out toys at Christmas time or birthdays, but my goodness, when is enough enough? Consider children in homes across America 1 week after Christmas. How many times did that $10 toy you stuffed in the stocking get more kids' attention than that $185 Ultra Elite Super Deluxe Director set? 1 Timothy 6 and verse 6 through 10 and also verse 17, it says, but godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. For we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap, and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Skip down to verse 17 also says, instruct those then who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to set their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. So again, I say wealth without contentment can make believers wander from the faith. James chapter 4, beginning in verse 13 and going through chapter 5, verse 5, tells me this. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow, for you are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is evil. For one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, for him, it is sin. Come now, you rich people, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have corroded, and their corrosion will serve as a testimony against you and consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you, and the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of armies. You have lived for pleasure on the earth and lived luxuriously. You have fattened your hearts in the day of slaughter. Wow. Wealth, again, has a way of changing people. It doesn't have to, but it can. How can we prevent this from happening? I mean, we shouldn't desire to live in abject poverty, right? Of course, but I think here's the secret. Money is meant to serve the manager. Let me take you back to Deuteronomy. The most amazing verse that, me being a covenant guy, I just love this verse. Deuteronomy in chapter 8 and verse 18. But you are to remember the Lord your God, for it is He, catch this, who is giving you the power to make wealth in order to confirm, other versions say, to establish His covenant, which He swore to your fathers as it is this day. It's to help keep His own covenant word to Abraham. Wealth in the right hands is used as a tool to establish and release and extend God's covenant truth and gospel to the world. Can we look at money like that? The Bible instructs us that is the way to view finances. Proverbs 10, verse 22 tells me this. It is the blessing of the Lord that makes rich, and He adds no sorrow to it. This is how the Father gives you access to worldly wealth and how it keeps you from losing your mind. You've got to keep it focused on the kingdom. It's His hand, not your hand, that supplies the source. And the child mindset recognizes this and doesn't enter into any kind of sorrow or pain or hurt or stress or worry or idolatry. So to review, number one, significance is not found in owning a bunch of things and stuff that we release back to the world at death. Number two, significance is not found in experiencing the thrills of carnality. Now, let's admit this. We are wired for experiences. I'm not saying we should just live in a boring bubble or drab routine of sleeping, eating, working, sleeping, eating, working. No, but we are at war, friends, with the sinful desires that are absorbed into our flesh. 1 Peter 2 and verse 11 and 12 tells me this, "Beloved, I urge you as foreigners and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe Him, glorify God on the day of His visitation." And then two chapters later, in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verses 3 and 4, we see the pagan lifestyle is basically humanism with no accountability. Check this out. "For the time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of indecent behavior, lusts, drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, and wanton idolatries. In all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them in the same excesses of debauchery, and they slander you. But they will give an account of Him who is ready to judge the living and the dead." You see this? It's not just the pull of the sinful behavior, but it's the pull for approval from others that you are participating in the sinful behavior with. So it's a double trap. Titus 3 and chapter 3, "For we too were once foolish, disobedient, deceived, enslaved to various lusts and pleasures, spending our life in malice and envy, hateful, hating one another. Passion, friends, without godliness is slavery." Titus says these people are all in, into the wrong thing. And Titus, I think, echoes Peter in saying, we used to all act like this. We act like the fool in our days past, but no more. Titus even adds the element of what incorrect outward passions does to our inner attitudes. Go to Hebrews 11. I want to show you something here. Hebrews 11 and verses 24 through 26. You'll recognize this one. "By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God rather than to enjoy the temporary pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. There is a definitive time stamp on sinful pleasures and experiences, and Moses, he saw this. He saw the bigger picture was at stake here, that God's name was, catch this, on him, and both reputations, both his and God's, and rewards were hanging in the balance. May we also have the right sense of our own time value on the earth. When I was in high school, there was a guest speaker at the church I attended, and he said something I have never forgotten 35 plus years later, and he asked us this. He said, what is the number one thing that you're trying to find time for? What is the number one thing in your heart, all things considered, that you're trying to find time for? He said, that is your secret place, that experiential place you secretly desire the most. And if God is not breathing and living in that place, then we may need to rethink the types of experiences we're continually seeking. Your senses, your body, your mind, they're all channels and avenues that God has given you to experience him in the earth. So again, significance is not found in experiencing the thrills of carnality. Again, Satan just wants to twist what God designed for our greatest and highest pleasure to be in his presence. Number three, significance is not found in knowing the right people in order to obtain a position where you are well known. Notice the key word in that sentence. I used it twice. Know. Knowing, not found in knowing the right people, and then becoming well known. Isn't this the greatest struggle inside of us? To be known? But not just to be known, but to be known as important or good or excellent at something. We all can wrestle with this, right? What is it that makes us worthy, that makes us lovable, appreciated, valued, treasured? Could Jesus's life on the earth give us the clues? Well, let's ask the question, why did Jesus run for the hills when the crowd tried to coronate him as king? Remember this account? John 6, the people tried to make him an earthly king and Jesus just bounced, ran away off to the hills. He wanted nothing of it. Funny thing is, he was a king and he is a king, but not in the way they wanted. Jesus knew that man's opinion of him is not what makes him a ruler. Jesus is the child king of the kingdom that's not of this world, a kingdom set forth by our Heavenly Father, yet he had to physically remove himself from their advances and run for the mountains to spend time with Abba, both to protect the people from making a huge mistake and also protect himself from the temptation. I think Jesus knew that his father's facts about their relationship was the only validation and security that he really needed. In Matthew 3 and also in Matthew 17, we find accounts of God the Father's audible voice acknowledging the sonship of Jesus and the love between them and the good type of pleasure that their relationship produced. We see in Luke 14, verses 7 through 11, Jesus picks up on this again in a parable that the Bible publishers called Parable of the Guests, but I prefer to call it Parable of the First Class Seats. In verse 7, now he began telling a parable to the invited guests when he noticed how they had been picking out the places of honor at the table, saying to them, whenever you are invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor. This is Jesus talking. For someone more distinguished than you may have been invited by him, and the one who invited you both will come and say to you, give your place to this person. And then in disgrace, you will proceed to occupy the last place. But whenever you're invited, go and take the last place. In other words, end of the row, end of the table, right? So that when the one who has invited you comes, he will say to you, oh, friend, move up higher. Then you will have the honor in the sight of all who are dining at the table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and the one who humbles himself will be exalted. Again, the kingdom of heaven is so upside down to our adult thinking. Jesus is saying it doesn't really matter where you sit because significance doesn't come from your position. And be careful to make assumptions. It was a known fact that the Pharisees took this stuff very seriously. And these kind of petty things only matter to adults who have forgotten to be children. Well, I think that's a good stopping point for this lesson. I hope that's helped you in some way to Remember, your significance doesn't come from things you do or things you own or people you know. It comes from knowing you are loved unconditionally by God and resting in that fact. In our next podcast, we'll take a look at lesson number 5 in this series. I'm calling this one, Bye-Bye Burdens, The Carefree Child. We'll see you next time right here on Word Search.